You know, I laugh at that every time they do it. We're live now, by the way. That's supposed to be an ad. Channel 56 asked us to prepare some spot ads that they could play. And that's one of them. I've played it many times before. For some reason, we can't seem to get it down to 56. The some reason being, there's got to be some follow-through back there in the VTR room bringing it up to people that did it. Somebody needs to put it on their to-do list to ask, when do you want us to get these copies and put them in proper form and take them down to 56. Maybe this hint will get it done. You never know who does one. But we're just playing the ad as our opening. Another company has been preparing a new opening for the festival. They've been preparing it, seems to me, like for a year. And eventually we'll get that. But in the meantime, I got tired of that globe with all those lines going around it. So we're playing these ads. Now it's live. And I'm going to be live until shortly, maybe a few minutes after 9 o'clock on this Sunday night. Super Bowl is still going on. Worst halftime show I've ever seen. Absolute worst halftime. I knew I'd get some response to tell me who was watching. I mean, about 50% of the heads are nodding in here. For the last however many years, I can't even count them up, when we were on Sunday afternoon, I had to fight the Super Bowl every Sunday afternoon. I said to my wife, thank God we're not on afternoon, but here we are at 7 o'clock fighting the Super Bowl. And, you know, the games was mostly defensive, and then it sort of broke open before the half. Lots of fights breaking out. Now you know all you need to know about it. The best thing about the Super Bowl was an ad of some guy trying to romance his girlfriend sitting on a carriage pulled by a white horse or a gray horse in the snow. Now, that one was classic. They're already laughing. I mean, that was the best. That was worth watching the Super Bowl. And back here, they've recorded it in case I wanted to see it. I don't care about the football game. This ad, I'm going to keep. I mean, here's this stupid little jerk. He's sitting there romancing this gullible blonde that's sitting by him. And they're all wrapped up in the snow. And he has his arm around. They're sitting on the carriage and the horses. You know, I know about horses. And there's gray horses standing there. And the guy decides to romance the girl. And he's pulling all these surprises on her. And he hands her, how about a candle? And I couldn't figure out what it was either. It looked like a pumpkin or a, I don't know what it was in. Some kind of thing he had a candle in. You know, she's, ah! And then he opens the Budweiser. He opens up, I have another surprise for you. He opens up the cooler that he bought, and there's Budweiser. I like Budweiser, all right. We used to compete all the time with Sally Wheeler, who was the favorite of Gus, the old Budweiser man. She was the heir, or one of the major heirs of the fortune, but she's in the horse business, having married Hunter and Saddlebred, not more Hunter than Saddlebred trainer. So we used to compete against Sally all the time. She and Dave gave us a horse, and it was always had fun with Sally Wheeler. So the Budweiser horses and everything. So that brought back some memory. But he opens this, and there's he's giving the candle, and she's sitting there so happy. And then he opens the Budweiser, the cooler, and there's the Budweiser. And just at that moment when he's about, I'm sure, to land a kiss that would cement them forever, but there's a side view of the horse, and he lifts his big white tail and breaks wind with an explosion and blows all the stuff in the face of the girl. The next picture, she's covered with charcoal and dirt and everything else. And the sound effects were unbelievable. Am I right? Sound effects were unbelievable. That was worth watching the Super Bowl for, and that's already passed. So there's no reason. Just watch me now. But I mean, that ad, I would pay them to let me use that ad. Now, I'd like messages from all of you who saw that and see if you agree that that had to be the best part of the Super Bowl program. There have been so many times I've wanted to do that to somebody. As I told you, this old sinning preacher, thank God, I see. I had visions of doing that to Azazel. I've been trying for 2 weeks to figure out how to say the shipping the sins on that goat of Azazel's. Man, I could do something with that ad. I'd just forget the girl and the candles and the thing. Just give me Azazel sitting in that buggy. Now get on the telephone. Now, can't you see some of these self-righteous preachers that don't want you to know they watch the Super Bowl, looking over at their wife when that ad happened, saying, I didn't understand that. But, you know, I'm testing my people. I'm finding out how many of them were watching the Super Bowl. And I'm finding out. Austin, Texas. I did see that ad. It was funny. I agree with you. Los Angeles. Classic commercial. I laughed my head off. Henderson, I missed the commercial, but I saw the halftime show. It was awful. Long Beach. The halftime show sucked. I agree with you, Dr. Scott. The horse blowing wind was the best part. All right, now that we've established that this is a real show and we're live and this isn't something you've ever heard before and we're on at the same time the Super Bowl's ending up, I know what you're going to do. Every time the music starts, you're going to check in on the Super Bowl and see what's happening. So until the Super Bowl is over, you use the time on the phone to make your reservations for the cathedral. Secret 16 is back in place. If you don't know what it is, you shouldn't participate. You regulars know what to do in this first half hour. Then I'm going to do some teaching. I'm going to do some hilarious stuff tonight. If I think you're grown up enough to handle it, that's why I sort of started with a shock. So get on the telephone for the next 20 minutes and make all your reservations so I can teach and not have to stop for you to make your calls. Right now, make every phone get busy. Come on. Now, we are again and still asking for volunteers that will make a commitment. We are filling a chart of every place, every location, on a daily basis. And I want to fill every spot 24 hours a day and Voices of Faith 24 hours a day. They're not going to happen if you don't call and make a commitment. 4 hours here, 8 hours, not just an hour here and an hour there. Come on, folks, step up to the plate and set this ministry free. Set us free. And the minute that paid staff are made dispensable, then maybe they can grow in the Lord. There's nothing worse than a paid staff member fill in a spot, he thinks you can't replace him, and then the devil unleashes everything on him to break him down. And this ministry needs to be free, as we prove we can run with volunteers if we have to. But we're also hiring people who want to commit their life. Now get on the telephone, there's about 14 more minutes, and then I want to start teaching. Come on. Now, About 5 minutes after 9 or thereabout, maybe 7 minutes, a little less than 2 hours from now, we'll take you to the cathedral for this morning's message, and it's pretty heavy. But I managed to sweep in the close of the 25th verse. I felt a sense that I could move on to the 26th verse. I wasn't going to do it until I felt that sense that the congregation, many of you came to it a long time ago. And I could preach on faith in the blood for another 20 years, taking every single type of the Old Testament. But we've singled out the critical ones. And as you saw, as I went to the 6th chapter toward the close, we'll address this issue of putting off the old man and putting on the new. And it will come up again. We will address the issue of the altar that sanctifies the gift when we come to the 12th chapter. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies. We become the gift. So I'm moving on to the 26th chapter, or the 26th verse, the Lord willing, as we move to close the third chapter and move into the fourth chapter with Abraham and David as the examples of faith. I'm going to have a little fun with David tonight, maybe, depending on how I feel 10, 15 minutes from now, and whether or not you keep the phones busy and get what some of the time, all week long, from 10 to 11, it's solid teaching. Solid teaching. Opening song, teaching, closing song. Nothing else. Sunday in these 4 hours is when I address my congregation, most of whom are television congregants. You should come to the cathedral at least once a month. And there's a solid core that are there every Sunday. You've got to make a reservation. We need it by Wednesday so we can mail the passes. I need volunteers. There are ladies in this church that can give 3 and 4 hours. You can give 4 hours, Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, to help with the mailing of the passes. And we can get it done with volunteers. But I want you to make your reservations now in the closing part of this half hour. The message will be very heavy when you hear it. But I feel that we've reached a point I can move on to the 26th verse, and I don't move on until I sense the congregation. I want to tell you something. When I finish Romans, you can take the whole series when I finish, and you'll understand the whole Bible. As I said when I opened it, Luther and many of the great scholars have said, if you understand this one sentence that occupies these six or seven verses, 21st to the 27th or thereabouts, you will understand the whole Bible and you'll understand the whole book of Romans. But I think you're seeing that when I finish Romans, I will have preached the whole Bible. You can take the Romans series and you'll know more than if you went to seminary, and you'll know more accurate and good and right stuff than if you went to seminary. Yes, sir. A complete course in Christianity will be this series on Romans. And don't anybody think they can listen to one message once and get it all. There's over 230 messages, and I'm just ending the 25th verse of the third chapter with the message that will follow tonight. But I repeat, when I finish the 16 chapters, if any of you live that long, when I finish the 16 chapters, you can take that anywhere in the world you want. CD-ROMs, videotape, and you have a complete course in Christianity. Better than a PhD in religion. That's what we're laying down. As you see, from Genesis to Revelation, faith in the blood certainly begins with God breathing into Adam in Genesis, and the overcame of the blood of the Lamb in the book of Revelation, though the guy I read from misapplied the text at that point. When I'm finished with Romans, you'll know the whole Bible. And I'm grateful to see new people are beginning slowly to come to the cathedral and come with the understanding it's a graduate class, college level teaching on the Bible. That's all there is. We're not trying to convert you. And when you understand the altar, as I talked about it today, it sort of makes altar calls a gross cheapening of what the altar is supposed to be. Like some little quick fix, and then you go away and your life is suddenly rosy. But that's for the message to come. Right now, I want you to make your reservations, and my congregants, you do what you know you're supposed to do. So get on the telephone. All right, it's not 7:30 yet, so you... And I don't see every phone busy. Now, come on, there's enough of our people watching. You can call. I mean, you can turn on the Super Bowl and still call. I need to know what the score is and how long before this thing's over. Then I can get serious about teaching. So all of you Super Bowl watchers out there, put a phone in one hand, watch, and give me the score. Then I can tell my people and they don't have to watch. Get on telephone. Now, one more song. And then I'm going to walk a tightrope. So get on the telephone. All right, no more calls. Everybody take your seat. Try to find a spot where I can see you. I mean, if you're behind the cameras, sort of move sideways so I can see you. That goes for you over there. You right straight back here. Get where I can see you when you finish your phone calls. I got to be able to see your expressions tonight. I have a live audience in here, I think. You're on the crane of your neck. Go with the lady back there. Go find a spot where I can see you. Get over here by, on the front row. Not you, Chris, right behind you, the lady with the glasses. Get out on the end or get over here. Right there, I see you. I want to see your expressions. You're having to crane your neck back there. Reggie, go find another place. Get on the back row. Steve, get in the back row. Now, this book, I don't know how many know about it, by Joseph Heller, God Knows, with a cartoon strip here with the words coming out of the cloud. Go figure. Now, he's a very humorous man. He's a very humorous man. He's a genius, absolute genius. He wrote Catch-22, which some of you will remember. Something happened, good as gold, and author of the play, We Bombed in New Haven. Now, there isn't any preacher in the world would read this book. They'd throw it in the air and scream blasphemy. I could wish that I had a congregation full of people that knew the Bible as accurately and detailed as he does. Now, I've been telling you that Paul looked through the Old Testament and saw Christ. And in this book, I can respect any honest man that looks at the facts and decides differently. This man knows the history of the Old Testament saints. He knows the Bible better than most preachers. But he sees humor. And whether it's his view or not, because it's a novel based upon David's recounting of the history of his people and David's views about things, including David's aggravation with God. He thinks God owes him something, beginning with an apology, a big apology. Now, if I can do this properly, you will see yourself in David. And, of course, I think Joseph Heller put himself in David. It has just an awful lot of cutting criticism of God. And it starts in the scene. You remember David in his old age, some of his age, decided his old bones could be warmed with a young, beautiful girl. So it sets the stage with the first chapter. Now, I'm sure I'll sell all the bookstores out. Starts with the first chapter, and I don't think that this is one I'd want to carry in my bookstore. You need me reading it. Abishag the Shunammite. That's the beautiful little girl that was sent to warm his old bones. No pun intended. Maybe a pun intended. No preacher on earth would read this book to you. My faith is so secure, I can look at the same words as with Paul's help particularly. And as I was preaching this morning, I wanted to say, I lost my faith and came back from a study of the resurrection. Then I spent another 2 or 3 years. I wasn't going to take somebody else's word for what was inspired. And I spent another 3 to 4 years studying Christ's use of the Old Testament. Once I established his authority, then I was going to pay attention to the books that he put real attention on. As with this morning, he quotes the passage about the altar He doesn't just quote it, he interprets it and applies it to himself. Obviously, this is a novel, but it's barbed. It's designed to treat the Bible as a novel. And he puts the color in it that should have been there and gives a different view of God than the Bible gives. I'm just going to start reading it. Do you understand? The same truth brings life to some and death to others. I've said to you how many times over these years, be grateful. When I taught on Ephesians, if there's any proof you're one of those chosen out from among those not chosen, is that your heart has a hunger and a response to learn about God and His Word. This is not being treated as God's Word. This is David's words, and I think David's rolling over in his grave at this caricaturization of the way he felt about things. But man, he gives you a running commentary on what he thought of Moses. I'll anticipate just one. My lines are better than his. And David's a real egomaniac. Too hot in here, Reggie. Turn the air on. I mean, I'm going to make things hot enough. I mean, he's a real egomaniac. And he's really PO'd that, and there's, I got to clean it up because David uses some really bad words in this novel. And he's, and you know, in the novel, David has the freedom. He comments on Michelangelo, and he likes Moses' statue better than his, and furthermore, Michelangelo got it wrong because I'm circumcised and that statue isn't. Now, this is the sort of tongue-in-cheek, but not so much tongue-in-cheek. So, you know, David has the freedom on his aged bed with the Shunammite woman that is supposed to keep him warm, of just sort of scanning history from the beginning clear up to the modern day and offering his rendition on it. And God bleeping up all the time. Got it? You got the frame? Now somebody's going to tune in and say, my God, he's gone crazy. He's preaching this now. Abishag, the Shunammite woman, washes her hands, powders her arms. Now he's on this old age. That's where it starts. He's watching this Shunammite woman. Washes her hand, powders her arms, removes her robe, and approaches my bed to lie down on top of me. I got to watch it as I go where I got to. I know even as she takes gentle possession of me with her small arms and legs and with her tiny plump belly and fragrant mouth that it will do no good. My shivering will continue, and she will fear she has failed me again. The chills that rack me grow from within. Abishag is beautiful. They tell me the child is a virgin. So what? I've had beautiful virgins before, and I felt a waste of my time. Both women I've loved most in my life were married when I met them, and had learned how to. Those are his favorite wives. Both women I've loved most in my life were married when I met them, and had learned how to please me through living with their first husbands. Both times I was lucky, for their husbands died at just the right time for me. Abishag, it's getting better. This is nothing. It gets better. Abishag, wait till he starts talking about Moses and Abraham and all this stuff. Abishag, the Shunammite, is a comely, tidy girl of a yielding and obedient nature and quiet, graceful motions. She bathes each morning, each afternoon, and each evening. Wow. She rinses her hands and washes her feet more often than that, and scrupulously cleans and perfumes beneath her arms each time before she draws near to feed me, cover me, or lie with me. She is slight and delicate in body and very young, with a smooth and dusky complexion, glossy, straight black hair combed back and downward, rolling outward at her shoulders into an even curl, and very large, meek, inviting eyes, with huge whites and dark irises that are almost the shade of ebony. Even so, I'd rather have my wife, who asks to see me now at least twice a day. But she comes only in anxious concern for her life and for the safety and future high station of her son after, so to speak, I'm no longer among the quick. She does not care about me, probably never really did. She wants her son to be king. Fat chance. He's my son too, of course, but I have others. More, I think, than I have memory left to name, should I ever try to list them. The older I get, the less interest I take in my children, and for that matter, in everyone and everything else. Who gives a damn for the country? My wife, large and wide-hipped, is a breathing contrast to Abishag in almost every vital respect. Unlike Abishag, she habitually has an unfriendly stare for everyone, and her eyes are blue, small, and keen. Her skin is fair. She still dyes her hair yellow with that mixture of saffron and loose stripes she perfected eons back after decades of trying. Tall, brazen, selfish, and formidable, she's more than a match for the shy servant girl and subjects her frequently to rude looks of inspection. With the native instinct of the born connoisseur, her scornful eye asserts confidently that she was always more knowledgeable than Abishag when it came to men. Probably she still is. Probably she always will be. But she's long since given all that up. As usual, my wife knows what she wants and is unashamed to ask for it. As usual, she wants everything and wants it now. You know what he's talking about, don't you? Bathsheba. With guilty gaze shifting nervously from mine, she feigns detachment from any ulterior motives. With an air of innocent and fluttering distractions to promises we both know I never made. And as usual, she is concentrated on her objective with an intensity so single-minded as to allow no consideration to any subtle strategy that it might actually assist in its fulfillment. She cannot make herself believe, for example, that I still might really love and want her. I continue to ask her to lie beside me. She feels we are both now too old. I don't. So to warm and minister to me instead, I have Abishag, the Shunammite, who has oiled her arms and lovely young brown breasts with sweet-smelling lotions and scented her neck, ears, and hair. Abishag will try her best without succeeding, and when she rises from my bed, I will be just as cold as before and just as forlorn. All day long, the light in my room is dreary, as though densely clouded, with too many invisible motes. The flames in my oil lamps flicker dimly. My eyes often close without any sensing that I'm again drifting off into another brief sleep. They usually feel gritty and flamed. Are my eyes red? I will inquire of Abishag. She tells me they're very red, soothes them with trickles of cool water and glycerin squeezed from strips of white wool. The weirdest silence prevails under my roof and outside my windows in the streets and seems to hold and muffle all the jarring noises of the city in a deadening grip. About my halls, my watchmen and servants go on tiptoe and speculate in whispers. Perhaps they're making bets. Jerusalem is prospering as never before, but the populace is astir with rumors and alarming expectations. The atmosphere is rife with suspense and increasing dread, with mounting displays of ambition, deceit, and hungering opportunism. None of this upsets me anymore. The people are splitting into opposing camps. Well, that's them. The threat of a bloodbath is already quivering electrically in the nightly sea breeze. Who cares? My children are waiting for me to die. Who can blame them? I've led a full, long life, haven't I? You can look it up. Samuel 1 and 2, Kings, Chronicles also. But that's a prissy whitewash in which the juiciest parts of my life are discarded as unimportant or unworthy. Therefore, I hate Chronicles. In Chronicles, I'm a pious bore, as dull as a dishwater, and as preachy and insipid as that self-righteous Joan of Arc. And God knows I was never anything like that. God knows I fleshed. I can't use his F word. So we know what fleshed means. And they don't even have an F with a line. It gets spelled out here, this book. God knows I fleshed and fought plenty and had a rousing good time doing both. until the time I fell in love and the baby died. Now, you know that story, where the firstborn of Bathsheba, as punishment, God's going to kill the baby, and the baby's going to die. Isn't that cruel? Well, the baby went to heaven. Punishing David. And David fasted and prayed and cried. God didn't answer his prayer. He says, I fleshed and fought plenty and had a rousing good time doing both until the time I fell in love and the baby died. Everything took a turn for the worse after that. And God certainly knows I was always a vigorous, courageous, and enterprising soul, overflowing with all the lusty emotions and desires of life until the day I waxed faint in warfare on the field at Gob and was succored by my nephew Abishai and grasped beyond all possibilities of continued self-deception that I had passed my physical peak and could never again be counted on to defend myself in battle. Between sunrise and sunset, I had aged 40 years. In the morning, I was feeling like an indestructible young man. In the afternoon, I knew it was an old one. Now, I don't like to boast, but I know I boast a bit when I say I don't have to boast. Let me read that again. I don't like to boast, but I know I boast a bit when I say I don't have to boast. But I honestly think I got the best story in the Bible. Where's the competition? Job? Forget him. Genesis? The cosmology is for kids, an old wives' tale, a fae fantasy spun by a nodding grandmother already dozing off into satisfied boredom. Old Sarah's fun. Now, she laughed and lied to God, and I still get a big treat out of that. Sarah's almost real in her generous, high-spirited good nature and rivalrous female jealousy. And Abraham, of course, is ever up to the mark, obedient, fair, judicious, and brave, always the perfect gentleman, intelligent patriarch. But where's the action once you get past Isaac and Hagar? Jacob stands up as narrative in a primitive way. And Joseph is pretty lively as the pampered, late-born, bratty favorite of his doting father. But he drops out kind of suddenly as a grown-up, doesn't he? One minute he's dispensing corn and land in Egypt as the preeminent agent of the Pharaoh. Just a few paragraphs later he's on his deathbed, breathing his last wish that his bones be carried up from Egypt someday into the land of Canaan. Another headache for Moses 400 years later. He knows his facts. Now, Moses isn't bad. I have to admit, he's very, very long, and there's a crying need for variation after the Exodus from Egypt. The story goes on and on and on with all those laws. Who could listen to so many laws even in 40 years? Go remember them. Who could write them down? When did he have time for anything else? And he had to pass on. Now, keep in mind that Moses was slow of speech. No wonder it took so long. Michelangelo made statues of us both. The one of Moses is better. Mine doesn't look like me at all. Moses had the Ten Commandments, it's true, but I got much better lines. I got the poetry and passion, savage violence, and the plain, raw, civilizing grief of human heartbreak. Listen to some of my lines. The beauty of Israel is slain upon the high places. Now that sentence is mine. And so is, they were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. My psalms last. I could live forever on my famous elegy alone, if I wasn't already dying of old age. I've got wars and ecstatic religious experiences, obscene dances, ghosts, murders, hair-raising escapes, and exciting chase scenes. There were children who died early. I shall go to him, but he shall not return to me. Now that's for the one who died in infancy. Because of me or God or both, take your pick. I know where I place the blame, on him. My son, was for another who was struck down in the prime of young manhood. Where in Moses can you find stuff like that? And then, of course, now we haven't even got to the heart of this yet. I mean, I'm only on page 6. Where in Moses can you find stuff like that? And then, of course, my favorite, that crowning jewel of a triumphal, paean that made me grin from ear to ear the first few times I heard it swell to greet me as I strutted along in my youthful exuberance and naivete. The pleasure soured quickly. Soon I was cringing in fright at the sound of the first of those lovely syllables and glancing over my shoulder in horror as though to evade a blow from some lethal weapon descending upon me from behind. How I grew to fear that rousing tribute to me. But as soon as the first of my mortal enemies had been killed, I found myself shamelessly cherishing again that unique accolade. And even now, in my shivering decrepitude, I am disposed to glow with pride and thrill with sexual thoughts at the picture of all those bare-legged girls and women in their tossing skirts of brilliant scarlet, blue, and purple, kicking up their sun-browned knees as they streamed out jubilantly from one hillside village and city after the next with tabrets and other instruments of music as we trooped back victorious once more, hailing us, me, gloriously again and again with that exultant, beguiling refrain, "Saul hath slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s." Imagine how Saul took to that one. I didn't imagine. The next thing I knew, I was dodging javelins to save my ass and running for my life. You think you've had problems with in-laws? I had a father-in-law who wanted to kill me. Why? Only because I was too good, that's why. Those were the days when butter wouldn't melt in my mouth. I couldn't do a single thing wrong if I tried. I couldn't make a bad impression on anyone if I wanted to, on anyone but Saul. Even his daughter took a shine to me and turned out a bitter shrew as the first of my 13, 14, or 15 wives. Michelle saved my life once, it's true. But that hardly justified all the vicious nagging I was subjected to afterwards. Wherever Saul went to fight, I went. And the better I was able to serve him in war against the Philistines, the greater grew his envy and furious suspicions that I was slated to replace him and was scheming already to do so. Was that fair? Was it my fault people liked me? By that time, of course, Saul had been repudiated by Samuel and subjected by God to one of those vast, terrible metaphysical silences that only someone truly almighty and as indispensable as the Lord has the power to inflict. Here I can speak from personal experience. I no longer talk to him, and he no longer talks to me. You want me to continue? Get on telephone. Well, the Super Bowl is over. Patriots 32, Panthers 29. Last time I heard, but that was ages ago, the spread was 7 in favor of the Patriots. A lot of people lost a lot of money. That's good. Wonderful. That's wonderful. If you went out and bet your first bet, sneaked out and did it, don't want your pastor to know it, God knows. If that's your first bet and you won, it's first fruits, so you can get anything anyway. Sit down, everybody. I'm reading from this book, God Knows, by Joseph Heller. It's demonstrating the same word brings different responses. What I'm amazed at is his knowledge of God's word and his audacious using David as the mouthpiece to humorously thumb his nose at God through David. And I'm not going to give any more induction than that. I'm going to keep reading. I just made it to the 7th page. Even my own heart, this is David in his old age, still in love with Bathsheba. The kingdom is divided, fighting over which son will succeed him. The Shunammite girl can't warm his old bones up. Still loves Bathsheba, and he knows her for what she is. And he's recounting his gripes with God. Even my own heart melted with compassion at news of Saul's affecting plaint at Endor on the eve of his death, that God would answer him no more, And this was long after I'd been anointed privately by Samuel in my father's house in Bethlehem and told, for whatever intelligence was worth, that I'd been chosen by the Lord to be his king in Israel someday. Now, I had a vested interest in his death, certainly. But I swear I was sometimes sorry for him, and that my hands were always clean. Never was I engaged in anything more sinister than trying to enlarge the affection and admiration with which he had first welcomed me into his fold on the day of my killing of Goliath. But his swings of mood were unpredictable and extreme, and there was seldom a clue beforehand as to when our noble, tortured general and first king would change into a raving lunatic once more and try to take my life. I want you to notice how well he knows all the little nuances of Scripture. There were times, it seemed, that he wanted to kill just about everyone. Everyone. Even his natural son, Jonathan. Now, there's a problem for you, isn't it? A father-in-law who spends the better part of his time and strength seeking your death, who sends assassins to your home at night to murder you in the morning, and leads armies of thousands of his best soldiers into the wilderness to run you to earth instead of using them to drive the Philistines back to the coastal plains where they belonged. He offered his daughter to me, only in the furtive hope I'd be killed, collecting the grotesquely low price he set for her, 100 Philistine foreskins. Saul suffered the paranoid delusion that even his daughter and his son were in sympathy with me, and he was thoroughly correct. I learned from this a fact applying to everyone that is probably of no practical use to anyone. There is wisdom in madness and strong probability of truth in all accusations, for people are complete and everybody is capable of everything. They were spooky. Tempestuous spells in which killing me was just about the only thing Saul had in his rabid and demented mind. The poor fleshing nut. Go figure him out. Now, I've got all those wars and conquests and rebellions and chases to talk about. I built an empire the size of Maine. And I led the people of Israel out of the Bronze Age and into the Iron Age. See, he can scan the centuries. This is David close to his deathbed. I got a love story. My lines are better than Moses. He already poo-pooed Chronicles and boring. They didn't tell the true story about him. Made him too tepid and boring. I got a love story and a sex story. With the same woman, no less, and both are great. And I've got this ongoing, open-ended Mexican standoff with God, even though he might now be dead. Whether God is dead or not hardly matters, for we would use him no differently anyway. He owes me an apology, but God won't budge and I won't budge. I have my faults, God knows, and I may even be among the first to admit them. But to this very day, I know in my bones that I'm a much better person than he is. Now, look in the mirror. Look in the mirror those times you want to criticize God's treatment of you. Although I never actually walked with God, I did talk with him a lot, got along with him in perfect rapport. Until I offended him the first time. Then he offended me. And later we offended each other. Even then he promised to protect me, and he has. But protect me from what? Old age? The deaths of my children and the rape of my daughter? God gave me long life and many sons to continue my name, although all of them have names of their own. But it's hot as hell today, and muggy as well, and I can't get warm. I get no heat, even with Abishag the Shunammite fondling and licking me and covering me with her sensuous, live, beautiful little body. Abishag, my Shunammite, has a goodly, sized, shapely ass for someone who is small and built on so delicate a scale. Am I offending you? I'm just reading the book. This is Joseph Heller, God. Guess what? I was a hunted criminal once with the, quote, man wanted sign out for me all over Judah. And not many people talk about that. I was a fugitive outlaw with a motley crew of 600 weather-beaten crooks and roughnecks at my command. One of his first mistakes in numbers. But close. Do you know what an organized band of 600 battle-hardened men amounts to? A formidable, disciplined, striking force any army would welcome, including Achish and his Philistines of Gath, as they mobilized for war against Israel and invited us to ally ourselves with him. Blame Saul that we accepted. And really did march off to war against Israel. Not many people know about that either, but there we were on the side of the Philistines as they massed for the Battle of Gilboa, where Saul was killed. Lucky for me, we were sent away by the Philistines before the fighting began. If I ever stole, plundered, or extorted with Judeans or Israelites as the victims, and I'm not admitting I did, Saul's to blame. He left me no alternative. You're looking through my messages at this? Somebody said, ah, yes, okay. How else was I expected to survive after he drove me away from him and turned nearly the whole country against me? The people of Ziph informed against me. The people of Maon told him where I had come to rest. And meanwhile, all I longed for was to go on loving him. I thought of Saul as my father. My father, I called from an undergrowth of thickets on the rocky hillside after I'd come upon him sleeping on the floor in the cave of En-Gedi and had cut a strip of the skirt of his robe to prove I'd been there. See, I kill thee not. Is this thy voice, my son David? He answered and wept. I will seek no more to do thee harm. The promises of maniacs like those of women. The promises of maniacs like those of women are not safely relied upon. Later, the Philistines cut off his head when they found him dead and nailed what was left of him to the walls of the city of Bethshan. Gory deeds. Remember, he's trying to say how much better what he wrote is to read than what Moses wrote. Gory deeds. I got more than enough for every taste. I have suicide, regicide, patricide, homicide, fratricide, infanticide, adultery, incest, hangings, and more decapitations than just Saul's. Listen, I had sons. I had concubines. I had a son who went into my concubines in broad daylight on the roof of my palace. I had a star named after me in London, England, yet in 1898. Who ever heard of a Star of Samuel? So Cain took the road and Adam was off the hook. But I had the whole jam-packed city of Jerusalem watching to see what I was going to do after Absalom killed Amnon. Now, a lot of Christians, a lot of preachers don't even know these names. Now the same thing's about to happen again. And I get to pick which will reign and which will die, Adonijah or Solomon. A painful decision. Only if I still cared about my children or the future of the country, but the truth is I don't. I hate God and I hate life. And the closer I come to death, the more I hate life. I'm far too old. Far too old, I feel, to be a father anymore. Although I'm not too old to be a husband, and I want my wife Bathsheba back in bed with me. I think I may have been the first grown man in the world to fall truly, passionately, sexually, romantically, and sentimentally in love. I practically invented it. Jacob took to Rachel the first time he laid eyes on her at the well in Haran. But Jacob was a boy, and that was puppy love compared to mine. He worked 7 years to get her, then worked seven more with her weak-eyed sister, when her weak-eyed sister was fobbed off on him in her place on his wedding night. I had Bathsheba the first day I saw her. I had fleshing from her that made my brain spin in those few great years. I enjoyed with her in which one day after the next I could think of nothing better I wanted to do morning, noon, evening, and night than fly back to her side and lock my hands and my stomach and other things and soul and to her flesh once more. Oh, boy, did I cleave to her. We loved to kiss and talk. We trysted secretly, embraced on the way to the couch, made giddy jokes, laughed excessively, enjoyed every other kind of cozy, intimate hilarity together until the day the roof caved in with the news she was pregnant. Holy bleep! That's what he said. Holy bleep on me. He didn't say bleep. Holy bleep were the words that sprang from my lips. I don't know whose idea it was to recall her husband Uriah the Hittite from the siege at Rabbah, Ammon, to legitimatize the fruits of my adulterous intercourse with his wife as the appropriate issue of his own, but I know it didn't work. Look at the detail this guy knows. Uriah, go home. I enticed him handsomely, sent a mess of meat and other victuals to his house to help fuel the licentious marathon Bathsheba and I had mapped out for him. Enjoy yourself. You have brought me good news of the campaign. The dope he elected instead to sleep like my servants on the floor of my palace, in chaotic and telepathic solidarity with his comrades in arms still encamped in the open fields of Ammon, and in frustrating obedience to our Mosaic laws respecting cleanliness and combat. You could not go into holy battle for at least 3 days after lying with a woman. Or a man either, for that matter, or even with a sheep, a goat, or a turkey. You want me to quit? You want me to quit? We haven't got to the good part yet. You couldn't go into holy battle for at least 3 days after lying with a woman, or with a man either, for that matter, or even with a sheep, a goat, or a turkey. People wishing to evade military service commonly lie with their wives, their concubines, or their turkeys just before call-up. We call this conscientious objection. But Uriah was not even a Jew. The law didn't apply to him. Go reason with a Hittite. Uriah, go home. I proposed, suggested, commanded, beseeched him frantically all the second day. Go home, Uriah. Please go home. Probably your wife is expecting you. Your wife is a luscious woman, I'm told. Stick it to her. Give her a bop or two. Stuff her. You've earned the pleasure. Again, he slept on my floor instead. Let me see. How do I get past this word? You know, there's a B word on the street for an illegitimate person. They're just calling Bobby. Did the Bobby know something? I felt myself going mad. I don't know whose idea it was to send him back into battle to be killed. Let's call that one hers. The widow Bathsheba moved into my palace as my eighth wife as soon as she finished mourning her dead husband. And immediately she asked to be queen. We have no queens. Would that stop my darling from continuing to ask? Within an hour after arriving in my palace, she had examined the apartments, closets, and cosmetic pots of all my other wives and demanded that her own be better and more. The ballsy baby was my favorite from the start. I took more delight in my love for Bathsheba than I did even in my love for Abigail, my elegant lady of quality and refinement, who fed me the best lentil soup, barley bread, and leeks I ever ate in my whole life and would be content to cook for me now if she were among the living. Bathsheba, when I met her, wouldn't put her hands in the dishwater. If there was any other way to avoid it or any other thing to do, and she never had to do it again once I took her as a wife. Now, she comes to see me now, in my old age, daily, only in a subversive effort to ensure her safety. Her native selfishness is fascinating still. It's heartening to perceive that some things never change. Didn't I once observe that there is nothing new under the sun? She knows much about making love, but not much about men. Or what can lie in our hearts, she hardly concerns herself with what might lie in mine. Instead, she keeps asking that I make Solomon king. No way! I started telling her laughingly the day he was born. There's a dozen ahead of him. Now there's only Adonijah. It's not myself I'm thinking about, she says, but the future of the people in the country. She's thinking only of herself. She cares no more about the future than I do. She insists that I've given her my word. I'm sure you must have made that promise to me sometime, she says. I could never make something like that up. Bathsheba could always make up any lie she chose and instantly believe it true. Her duplicity is transparent, but never underestimate the power of a woman. See what happens in Kings 1. I'm the best there, too. Solomon may have more space, but is there anything in his whole life to compare with any portion of mine? The only smart line he ever spoke, the one directing Benaiah to kill Joab in the tabernacle, he got from me. All the good ones in Proverbs are mine, and so are the best in the Song of Solomon. Study my last charges. They're marvelous, witty, dramatic, chromatic. With Shimei, I'm merely ingenious. I'm infinitely more decisive than my kinsman Joab, loyal lifelong companion and courageous military captain over my host for almost my entire career. Not once has he wavered in his allegiance to me, and even now, in ripe old age, he has committed his hardy arm and forceful authority to safeguarding the remainder of my rule and securing the orderly transfer of my throne to the only heir with a legitimate claim to receive it. For sturdy, loyal, valiant Job, I decree, kill him! Waste him! Blow the bleepity bleep away! I was always full of surprises, wasn't I? And I was smart enough to appreciate that for Solomon, you had to spell everything out. I'll let you in on a secret about my son Solomon. He was dead serious when he proposed cutting the baby in half. That puts, I swear to God, the dumb son of a bee was trying to be fair, not shrewd. Do you understand what I'm saying to you about Joab? I asked him with a look of intense scrutiny and waited for his leaden nod before I added for stress, don't let his forehead go peacefully down to the grave. Solomon lifted his eyes from the clay tablet on which he was scratching his notes and asked, what's a forehead? Abishag! The Shunammite woman. Abishag showed him to the door and petted my heaving chest until she felt my exasperation abate. Then she washed and dried herself, perfumed her wrists and armpits, removed her robe to stand before me a moment in all her wonderful virginal nakedness before raising a leg gracefully to enter my bed on one of her biscuit-brown knees to lie down with me again. Naturally, it did no good. I got no heat then either. I wanted my wife. I want my wife now. Bathsheba does not believe this and would not let it make a difference if she did. I don't do things like that anymore, Bathsheba responded firmly. Each time I ask, and if out of sorts, adds, I'm sick of love. She lost her lust when she found her vocations. Her first was to be queen. Too bad that we had no queens. The next was to be a queen mother. The first in our history, the widowed mother of a reigning sovereign. I refused to trade and I refused to grovel. I could order her into my bed with a single cursory command, of course, and she certainly would be here, but that would be begging, wouldn't it? I'm David, the king, and I must try not to beg. But God knows that by one means or another, I'm going to lie with her at least one more time before I give up the ghost and bring my fantastic story to an end. You want more?
Yes, sir.
Now, let me hunt and track a little bit. Let's go to Moses. It's hard to miss anything. Let's go to Moses. Well, let's pick this one up. Trust in the Lord. For a twist like that, I lost my God and my infant in the same instant. Until he lifted my sin from me and placed it on my baby, God and I were as friendly as anyone could imagine. I inquired for guidance whenever I wished to. He could always be counted on to respond. Our talks were sociable and precise. No words were wasted. Should I go down to Keilah and save the city? I asked while still a fugitive in Judah. Go down to Keilah and save the city, he answered helpfully. Should I go up into Hebron and Judah and allow the elders to crown me king? I asked after receiving news of Saul's death and completing my famous elegy. Why not? God obliged me in reply. Without fail, the answers I received from him were those I wanted most to hear. And it often seemed I was talking just to myself. I suffered none of that volcanic bullying with which the life of Moses was blighted from the day God entered it. or even 1 second of agony from that profound and bleak unbroken silence that drove Saul at length to the forbidden witch of Endor to commune in desperation with the spirit of Samuel, the man more responsible than any other human for the deteriorated condition of his mind. Are you following this?
Yes, sir.
This man knows that it didn't affect him, at least not in the mind of this novel. When Samuel broke with Saul and cast him adrift on our harrowing world with just his own flimsy resources to rely upon, he took all hope of God away from Saul permanently. There was never again a word or a signal for Saul that anyone above was watching or that anyone cared. Burnt offerings could just as well have been used for chopped meat. Propelled by his miserable need, Saul went to the witch of Endor to learn, you see how he knows every detail? To learn from the ghost of Samuel the outcome of the Battle of Gilboa, which the armies of the Philistines and the Hebrews were preparing to fight the following day. And Samuel let him have it right between the eyes. Saul would die on the morrow. Jonathan would die. Two other of his sons would also die. And the Israelites would be routed thoroughly and scattered from their houses and their tents. Samuel, or rather Saul, needed that knowledge like a hole in the head. His morale was low enough. A larger nature than Samuel's might have pressed good counsel upon him. What would have hurt Samuel to tell Saul, don't fight? Let him move through the valley of Jezreel. How far can they go? Hammer them from the hills, harass and skirmish, procrastinate and postpone. Slash them from the rear, smite them in the flanks, aggravate them. How long can they last under that? But Saul's day was drawing to a close, and mine was destined to dawn. Destiny's a good thing to accept when it's going your way. When it isn't, don't call it destiny. Call it injustice, treachery, or simple bad luck. Now my day is drawn to a close. While Adonijah and Solomon jockey for position and Bathsheba, lobbying for her son, visits me with devious and transparent intent, coached in the background by Nathan, who rightly presumes himself on very tenuous ground. If I die tomorrow, Nathan will not outlive me by much. And God seems to be keeping out of things these days. Miracles are past. For Bathsheba, all show in the well-being of other people is an effort of the will that she is able to exert for about a minute. Inhibition is not natural to her. Tact is foreign. She shows me her newest underwear. She still designs those things on occasion to keep busy. If Abishak is ministering to me, she'll watch dully and make critical suggestions casually, like a retired veteran giving pointers from the sidelines. He never liked that, she might tell the willing servant girl, with her drowsy face resting on her hand, her lids half lowered in boredom. That way used to be better with him. Why don't you moisten your fingertips with something slippery, dear? Honey's good. Olive oil's the best. Good olive oil. You do what I've suggested. You want me to continue? Get on the telephone. All right. No more calls. I'm going to read a little bit more, and then I'm going to stop for a minute and get some of your reactions. He skipped over a lot of things, and he got to where he's talking about Moses again. This is David approaching his death, lamenting his loss of contact with God, which never really occurred. This is not how you can weave this novel using David as the mouthpiece and know all the detail and still treat it like a joke. Take off your shoes. He's over to Moses. Was the first he heard from the burning bush. You stand on holy ground. There went the rest of his life. To talk the Pharaoh into releasing the Hebrews from Egypt was going to be hard enough. To organize a harmonious resistance movement and persuade the Hebrews to follow him out was not going to be much easier. To follow, maybe, without argument and fault-finding, impossible. Like striving for the wind. He stuttered, you know. Stop that, Moses, said the Lord. I fixed your stammer, didn't I? Am I that they should continue to believe me? How, Moses, shall I answer when they ask for your name? I am that I am. Moses stepped back with a look of pain. Again, I am that I am. Why not? They look darkly at me now and murder curses already. What? Will you stop that? What will they say when the hardship increases? Vesmer is what they did say when the hardship increased, which translated means woe is me. The Pharaoh bore down harder as they rolled and they toiled in the field and labored with mortar and brick. I'm still hardening his heart, the Lord replied when Moses objected. Don't you dare tell me again that it makes no sense. That's a commandment. I'll take care of Pharaoh. You take care of the people. I think you're going to have your hands full. That was no lie. What would have happened had Moses said no? As though taking note of the volume of conversation that necessarily lay ahead, God did give Moses a brother named Aaron in whose mouth they could put words, then a sister named Miriam to pitch in as a prophet. Otherwise, with Moses' slow of speech, the 10 plagues could have amounted to 20 and the 40 years of wandering to 400. In departing from Egypt, they wisely avoided the way of the land of the Philistines and headed southward through the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him. The grumbling and kibitzing he deplored were aggravating him from the start, along with that peculiar, ironical statement shaped in the form of a rhetorical question which we Jews invented and with which we've been identified since the day Cain responded. Am I my brother's keeper? What's the matter? Was the snarling recrimination with which the crowds descended upon Moses when they saw the Egyptian chariots racing after them. What's the matter? Are there no graves in Egypt that you had to lead us out here to die in the wilderness? Now, that was another good one. By the middle of the second month, he got it down, the details. The whole congregation was murmuring in hunger against Moses and Aaron and missing the good old days of bondage in Egypt where they sat with the flesh pots and ate bread to the full. Moses was defensive. The Lord sent manna. They preferred the flesh pots and bread. God gave them some quail and poisoned them for eating it. And he spoke. He spake. And he spake. And he spake. And he spake a lot to Moses. And then he spake and spake to Moses some more. There was so much spaking, it's a wonder Moses had time to walk. Not one word of thanks or praise, not one word ever. Never anything to anyone afterward about missing him when he was gone. The good Lord just never seemed to tire of speaking to Moses, blowing up over one thing or another, with threats of mass annihilation and laying down the laws one day after the next, all through Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. He wrote them on stone with his finger. For him, that was easy. But Moses was the one who had to bear the heavy tablets down the mountain. And that time that he smashed them when he saw the golden calf, he had to go all the way back up the mountain for another set. 40 years this went on with God wrathful and fulminating and the people recalcitrant, stiff-necked, and disobedient. Till that day arrived when, weary enough to want to wash your hands of it, I'd bet he hiked up Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah for his look across Jordan at the Promised Land. He was barred from entering for some undisclosed trespass neither I nor anyone else had been able to figure out. Not true. And shortly thereafter, though his eyes were not dim, nor his natural force lessened, Moses died. No one even to this day knows the place of his sepulcher. Some promised land. The honey was there, but the milk we brought in with our goats. To people in California, God gives a magnificent coastline, a movie industry, in Beverly Hills. To us, he gives sand. To Cannes, he gives a plush film festival. We get the PLO. Our winters are rainy, our summers hot. To people who didn't know how to wind a wristwatch, he gives underground oceans of oil. To us, he gives hernia piles and anti-Semitism. Those leery spies returning from Canaan after their first look describe the place as a land that eats up its people. A land inhabited wholly by giants. The reports were false, but not altogether off the mark. True, there were figs, pomegranates, and clusters of grapes so heavy they could be borne back only on a thick staff shoulder between two men. But the land does tend to eat up its people. Still, it's the best that's been offered us, and we want to hold on to it. Only Joshua and Caleb of the 24 taking part in the first exploration had confidence enough in the destiny proclaimed by the deity to wish to move forward. The people balked at the black picture painted by the others. Push on! Push on! The Lord sought to rouse them when he found them mired in consternation. I will send hornets before thee. I promise. The dukes of Edom will be amazed. The mighty men of Moab will tremble. The inhabitants of Canaan will melt away. Fear and dread shall fall upon them, and they'll all be still as stone. You'll drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, the Hittites, and the Perizzites, and the Jebusites too. He knows them all. He's got his Bible down. They'll turn their backs and run. Nothing can stop you. I give you my word. Nobody budged. The Lord resolved to strike him dead on the spot. He was livid. The Lord was wroth. I'll kill them all, he roared to Moses. You think I'm joking? How much more do you think I'm going to be provoked by these people and do nothing? How many more signs do I have to show them before they begin to believe? I did it before, once with a flood, once with fire and brimstone. Stand back, Moses! Can't we reason together? Moses began earnestly to deter him, emphasizing that God would become a laughingstock to the Egyptians for destroying his chosen people after taking them so far and promising them so much. They will tell the people of other lands who will laugh at you also and no longer fear you. They'll say we were killed because you were unable to lead us in, not because we were unable to follow. They will believe you failed, not us. All right, relented God, who did not wish to become a laughingstock in Egypt. He aimed his thumb over his shoulder in a jerking motion and commanded, start walking, hit the road. And back into the wilderness of Paran near Kadesh Barnea they went for another 38 years until all who had murmured against God then had given up the ghost and one generation had passed away and another generation had come. If God ever remembered, it certainly won't be. If God is ever remembered, it certainly won't be. Let me continue.
Yes, sir.
It certainly won't be for his patience and human kindness, will it? Of all who had traveled from Egypt, Joshua and Caleb were the only ones allowed to enter the Promised Land. When the Lord said, Hear, O Israel, thou art to pass over Jordan this day, Joshua and Caleb led their forces across Jordan to Jericho and embarked upon the conquest of Palestine that nobody till me was able to complete. David speaking. The land of Palestine is still a vigorous place of diverse and mutually enriching cultures. The difference now is that it's all of it is mine. David talking. Don't ever get the idea he made things easy for me. Life as one of God's chosen has never been a bed of roses. Ask Adam, ask Eve. Give a look at what he did to Moses and what happened to Saul. God might have set up things for my encounter with Goliath, but I still was the one who had to kill him. I had to work and suffer like a dog almost all my life. I was nearly 40 years old before I reigned in Jerusalem, and everything I got I earned with the sweat of my brow. Joseph sheltered and preserved us. Moses brought us to the border. Joshua took us in, but I'm the one who finished God's job. And God knows I think that he owes me at least something for the part I played in helping him reach his goal. Imagine how he would rate today if we'd never even got here or been exterminated after we did. He also knows I expect to be rewarded before I die, not after. He owes me an apology, too, at the very least. I'm not saying I shouldn't have been punished for those sins I committed. I'm saying that the punishment he chose was inhuman. I wonder what favor I'd want. I think I may be afraid to ask for it. I'm afraid he won't grant it. I'm more afraid that he will. Wouldn't it be tragic to find out that he really has been here all the time? God does have this self-serving habit of putting all blame for his own mistakes upon other people, doesn't he? He picks someone arbitrarily. Listen close. You know, this is different views of God's doings. Of course, if you're God, you can criticize God. And David, in this novel, is taking God's place. He thinks he's on top. God does have this self-serving habit of putting all blame for his own mistakes upon other people, doesn't he? He didn't have any business putting that tree in the garden. He picks someone arbitrarily, unbidden, right out of the blue, and levies upon him tasks of monumental difficulty for which we don't always measure up in every particular, and then charges us for his error in selecting imperfectly. I never wanted to be a pastor. Well, You know, there's a lot more to read in this book, but I don't want to bore you. We're going to go shortly after 9. I might go back. There's some real choice pieces. But if you understood the tightrope I'm walking here, I think the man's a genius. Through David, he projects a view of the way God is, and in the history of his book, totally different from the one that claimed me when I went from Christ's resurrection to the book. And as I didn't say, because of the time I was fighting in the message, I finally came to the place no mortal hand could weave that fabric of types and shadows in the Old Testament, fulfilled so perfectly in Christ. They had to, in the types, separate the tabernacle into the various parts, all of which were fulfilled in Christ. The priest, the sacrifice, the offerer, the altar, all in Christ. And in that trip to the heavenlies, we have a tabernacle that we worship at, not made with hands. Read Hebrews 9 and 10. The tabernacle with its altar, with its hilasterion, that was Christ. It all went up there. And the benefits from all of it now flow to us as you will listen to the message that comes. The man's a genius. He knows every detail. I found about 3 mistakes so far. And it's humorous. And if you'd like me to read some more of it, I'll do it. But you've got to respond to me. If I don't do it now, I can do it some other time. You remember Holy Blood, Holy Grail? That wicked lover crept for at least a month. Get on the telephone. And now I've entertained you, and I know my crowd. You'll go out and buy this book. God knows, and you'll read it yourself. And that's what I hope happens to the author, as long as you understand. He ends the last line of this book David, as death is closing fast, I want my God back, and they send me a girl. That's where the book ends. But it's very entertaining, and it's a weird view of the reality. Look through and draw different conclusions. You're going to call me. You're waiting for me to read some more, aren't you? You just get on the phone, and then we'll see what I'll do. Now, I just want to entertain you, but I also had another message. And this caricatured view of David, it's a novel, geniusly written and twisted. If you want the true picture of David, the man after God's own heart, and his true view of God, read Psalm 51. And he will be raised before the millennium and will rule on earth again, if the Bible's true. And I believe it is. And keep listening as I now move on in Romans and come to the 4th chapter, where Abraham and David are pictured aright. This is humorous. It's tragic that one can know so much about that record and not see through it to Christ. In all these recitals, he knows the book. It reminds me of the Pharisees. The Lord was in their midst. The Messiah was there. And they didn't recognize him because they put their own twist on God's revelation. That's why I teach folks. I hope you enjoyed the humor. I have a congregation strong enough to read this book and enjoy the fun. And even look in the mirror and see how stupid we get sometimes when we argue with God and blame him and decide that he's always blaming us for his mistakes. As I said, I didn't want to be a pastor. So, you know, why don't you write God a letter tonight and tell him that you wish you'd listened to me. Or the other way around. Now, if you had fun, that's what this was for, because the next 2 hours, as we go past the 9 o'clock hour, will be very serious as we take you into the cathedral for this morning's final message, I think, on Romans 3:25. I can finally move on to the 26th verse. And I want my people to respond. Reggie, the 300. The 300. We have the 700 and the 300. The 300 in secret 16 have now moved up to 103, so move that up to 100 also. So now we're working on the second 100 in both cases. If you don't know what secret 16 is, you shouldn't participate. If you do, we're adding a double whammy to the devil's number. Let him stuff it with 16 twice. You that know, make your commitments early enough in the year so you can finish it by Christmas. Make your reservations for the cathedral. And in the next 7 minutes at least, will you keep these phones busy? I may return to Heller again. That's funny. But it's tragic also that the same words bring life to some and death to others. Thank God if you're one that's responding to the word. Get on the telephone. I think we're about 5 minutes from the time I want to take us into the cathedral. Now, I want these phones to ring. I just had to wake up a couple of voices of faith. Move people around. You better keep them busy with the phones. So, get started. You got only this song, probably, before we go into the cathedral. So get on the telephone.